Duck has been offered a light sentence for his cooperation. Dixon was offered immunity for his cooperation. Calvin Robinson was convicted. Duck's attorney insists that Duck acted alone and will not be providing information on Bay Area attorneys and possibly federal judges when he testifies before a federal grand jury. Skipping down on the story, thousands of businesses and individuals were involved with Duck in bankruptcy matters. A letter on file with the Department of Justice states that both U.S. Attorney Joseph Russoniello and Robinson, quote, were well aware of Mr. Duck's misconduct as long ago as 1985. So his attorney, that is to say Charles Duck's attorney Peter Robinson, against U.S. law, is representing him in a case involving his former officer Joseph Russoniello, U.S. attorney in San Francisco, about whom we're going to say more in a minute. Significantly also, perhaps, he is involved with a reputed member of the Medellin cartel, as well as with another Lenvest vice president, David Dixon. So this is an interesting connection here, and apparently, at least according to the information here, an illegal connection, and quite possibly significant. Now, more here on the situation of Charles Duck, the Lenvest trustee, and Peter Robinson, former assistant U.S. attorney, assistant to Joseph Russoniello, with whose office, I should say, this deal was cut. More on this again from the Napa Sentinel of Tuesday, November 7th of 1989. Once again, coming to bat, Harry V. Martin, and this article is called Fooling Them, subheaded The Elusive Duck Tales Continue. I like that pun. Skipping down in the story, the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco and Santa Rosa, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Criminal Investigation Service of the Internal Revenue Service were all asked to investigate Duck as early as August 20th, 1986. Peter Robinson, an assistant U.S. attorney, was included in the request for an investigation of Duck. Robinson is now Duck's attorney. Under federal law, a former U.S. government attorney cannot represent a client who is part of an investigation of that office for at least 2 years after the attorney has left government service. Robinson has not been out of government service for 2 years yet. Robinson also represents David Dixon, a former Lenvest officer. Now, the thing that's so interesting about the connection between Peter Robinson and Charles Duck and Joseph Russoniello is that in a famous case that was, I believe, in 1986, although I'm not sure offhand of the year, a group of people were involved with cocaine smuggling, and as it turns out, there was every indication that this cocaine smuggling was going on behalf of the Contras. This became quite clear, and even though the apparent criminal conduct was beyond dispute, Joseph Russoniello, the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, turned the money, the proceeds, back over to the Contras, even though the proceeds came from a criminal investigation. Interestingly enough, although it may be apocryphal, Joseph Russoniello is reported, I can't absolutely verify it, but is reported to have been the college roommate of Rudolph Giuliani, the former U.S. prosecutor who figures so prominently in the December surprise hypothesis and appears to have been a ringer in the investigation, or perhaps alleged investigation would be a better term here, of the Iran-Contra scandal. That may be totally apocryphal, but it may also represent elements of an old boy network. Certainly, those things do exist. And again, it may be totally apocryphal and irrelevant, but it may represent something of an old boy network. So it is, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. Now, the Charles Duck Lenvest angle begins to re-intersect in a big, big way with the drug tug aspect of the case. In the Napa Sentinel of Friday, November 3rd of 1989, in the small section called Up the Wall by Harry V. Martin once again, we find this little item. We have been flooded with calls, faxed documents, and express packages all about former Lenvest trustee Charles Duck. His embezzlement is so widespread, the court system may never get to the bottom of it. One report, which we have not verified as yet, is that he flew by LACSA Airlines out of Los Angeles last summer to Costa Rica. The person he reportedly flew down with and stayed with was Dr. John Duff. More later. So that at this stage of the game was unconfirmed. However, once again, the Napa Sentinel, and this time we turn to the Napa Sentinel of Friday, November 24th of 1989. Once again, on page 2 in the Up the Wall section by Harry Martin, we find the following, an apparent confirmation of the Charles Duck, John Duff rendezvous. In a small section headlined, What About the Manifest?, it reads, We've told you about the report that former LenVest trustee Charles Duck reportedly flew to Costa Rica with former NAPIN Dr. John Duff, who had ties with CIA-supported John Hull. Where is the manifest of those flights? Under lock and key. The manifests were subpoenaed by a U.S. congressional committee looking into the CIA involvement in drugs and arms with the Contras. Apparently, the manifests are being used to check out all the people who flew in with Ken Armitage-supplied Costa Rican passports and those with illegally obtained diplomatic passports. You will find several NAPA names on those lists. So not only, apparently, is the Charles Duck, John Duff trip a factual event. In other words, it does not appear to be an unconfirmed report. It looks pretty confirmed at this stage of the game. But apparently, much of the information is unavailable because the manifests have been subpoenaed by a congressional committee looking into U.S. complicity in the drug traffic. So basically, that is the next update in the drug tug LenVest case. We're going to take a short musical break and then come back with a little more information, possibly relevant to this, certainly dealing with the same kinds of elements. So the main point here being the Charles Duck connection. Bear in mind the Duck connection to Peter Robinson, his attorney, who in turn hooks up with Joseph Russo. By the way, with regard to Joseph Russo's returning of the money to the Contras, in a miscellaneous archive show called The Ultimate Evil Part 3, that an article about that particular case is in the archives. Beyond that, in Penthouse Magazine's issue of July of 1989, there's an excellent article called Snowbound by John Cummings and Ernest Volkman. There is also a brief reference to that case in that particular article. But in our archives, in the archives on audio archives, The Ultimate Evil Part 3 actually contains a reading of the Russo article. And, of course, with the connections between Robinson and Mr. Bettecera of the Medellin cartel and David Dixon, it's fascinating. And then when we have the apparent Charles Duck, John Duff connection with all of the connections of John Duff to John Hull and quite possibly Howard Lonsdale as well, this certainly becomes an interesting situation, and it continues to, this particular swamp continues to deepen. Name three articles here which may intersect with the drug tug LenVest case, certainly involving the same elements. I'm going to review an article that we've read in the past on this program. Research credit on this goes to a listener. This is an article from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, May 15th of 1989. This is an article by Lance Williams of the Examiner staff. It's headlined, Chief Outraged by Cops' Charges of Conspiracy, subheaded Former NARC Alleges Department Tie-In with Drug Cartel, and it reads in part as follows. A San Francisco policeman says he was reprimanded, transferred, and threatened with death for attempting to investigate allegations that the notorious Medellin cocaine-dealing cartel was paying bribes to narcotics officers here in 1986. In a lawsuit filed last month in U.S. District Court, Officer Alfredo de la Cerda, last name capital D-E, capital L-A, capital C-E-R-D-A, charges that Chief Frank Jordan conspired with other department officials to sidetrack an inquiry into allegations of massive corruption in the department's narcotics unit. The officer says his career has been wrecked as a result of the department's heavy-handed efforts to shut down his inquiry, and at one point he was hospitalized and treated for depression. The lawsuit seeks $5 million in damages and a court order to erase the letter of reprimand he received in connection with the matter. Skipping down, in the complaint, the officer says that in 1986 he began hearing from informants, including suspects who later were convicted of drug crimes, that narcotics officers were tipping off cocaine dealers about planned raids by agents of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. In exchange for the tips, De La Cerda says he was told, the policemen were being paid as much as $5,000 per month by dealers associated with Osvaldo Trujillo Blanco, a Colombian national and leader in the Trujillo faction of the Medellin cartel. He since has been convicted of drug dealing and imprisoned. According to the complaint, one of the officers allegedly taking payments was Santos, then the narcotics unit's commander, and another was Officer Paul Macavecas, Santos's former partner, last name Macavecas. In an effort to investigate the allegations, De La Cerda and a sergeant in the department's Management Services Division, Thomas Bywater, capital B-Y-W-A-T-E-R, flew to Miami to interview a Guatemalan informant. According to the lawsuit, the informant gave De La Cerda an account of the activities of what he called the Nicaraguan connection in the San Francisco Police Department, narcotics officers of Latin heritage who allegedly had been corrupted by the Trujillo faction. That last sentence again. According to the lawsuit, the informant gave De La Cerda an account of the activities of what he called the Nicaraguan connection in the San Francisco Police Department, narcotics officers of Latin heritage who allegedly had been corrupted by the Trujillo faction. In an effort to keep the trip a secret, De La Cerda says he and Bywater used vacation time to go to Miami and paid for it out of their own pockets. So an apparent, at least according to that information, Medellin connection to the San Francisco Police Department. It hasn't been borne out absolutely, but at least we can say that there are indications of a Medellin connection to the SFPD. And that's also interesting to contemplate in light of the curious behavior of U.S. Attorney Russinello in returning the profits to the Contra group that had been convicted, some of whose members had been convicted, of trafficking in cocaine. Now, whether or not there's any connection between the article I just read and the one I'm about to read remains to be seen. This is, as I like to say so often, food for thought and grounds for further research, and it may in fact be a hard connection. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, November 21st of 1989, this past Tuesday, we find the following article. It's by Philip Matier, or Matier, M-A-T-I-E-R, and Andrew Ross of the Examiner staff. It's headline, Nelder Quits SF Police Commission. It reads in part as follows. In a swift changing of the guard, former San Francisco Police Chief Al Nelder has abruptly resigned from the powerful police commission, clearing the way for Mayor Agnos to replace him with Iran-Contra prosecutor John Keeker, or Keeker, K-E-K-E-R. Skipping down in the story, Keeker, 44, served as lead trial prosecutor in the Iran-Contra case against Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, a former White House aide. Well, I don't know very much about Mr. John Keeker. It remains to be seen just exactly what he does in this particular capacity as a member of the police commission. But certainly the prosecution of Oliver North was less than vigorous, and with the December surprise at all, it'll be interesting to see whether or not there's any connection between the allegations of a Medellin connection to the SFPD, the apparent complicity of the U.S. Attorney's Office in some of the Contra drug trafficking, the connections between that U.S. Attorney's Office and the drug tug case, and Oliver Norris, or the lead prosecutor in the alleged prosecution of Oliver North. Well, whether all of those things connect directly remains to be seen. A fascinating and nauseating development, predictable perhaps, came this past week in which Joseph Fernandez, the CIA station chief, or former CIA station chief in Costa Rica, had charges dismissed against him. Reading from the Los Angeles Times of Saturday, November 25th of 1989, we find the following L.A. Times story by Robert L. Jackson of the Los Angeles Times. It's datelined Alexandria, Virginia, and headlined, U.S. Judge Drops Charges Against Ex-CIA Agent. It reads in part as follows. A federal judge Friday dismissed all charges against a former CIA station chief indicted in the Iran-Contra scandal 2 days after Attorney General Dick Thornborough barred the courtroom disclosure of classified information. Sound familiar? The information withheld by Thornborough is essential to this defendant, said U.S. District Judge Claude M. Hilton. The judge ignored pleas from a prosecutor that a workable scheme could be developed to bring to trial Joseph F. Fernandez, the former CIA station chief in Costa Rica. Skipping down. Citing his powers under the 9-year-old Classified Information Procedures Act, Thornborough ruled out the use of sensitive government documents at trial that could disclose the existence of U.S. programs and CIA bases in Latin America. He was the first attorney general to exercise his power as final arbiter of what classified material may be withheld from a criminal proceeding. Skipping down again, a career intelligence officer, Fernandez was indicted on charges he made false statements about these activities to a 1987 panel appointed by then-President Ronald Reagan. Fernandez was also accused of lying during a separate inquiry by the CIA inspector general. Fernandez said outside the courthouse that the past years had been extremely difficult for me, unquote. The prosecution of working intelligence agents, quote, sent a chilling message to the men and women of the CIA's clandestine service, unquote, he said, and skipping down once again. G. Robert Blakey, B-L-A-K-E-Y, a law professor at the University of Notre Dame, said that, quote, every defendant has a preeminent right to a fair trial. Of course, the government has a right to prove its charges, and a judge must not go to extremes in throwing out a government case, Blakey said. It's a difficult balance, but where the two rights cannot be reconciled, a judge properly can throw out a case, unquote. Blakey, who once negotiated with the CIA for access to documents as chief counsel of a House committee, said the agency, quote, is paranoid about acknowledging they do what they do. They absolutely will not admit to or give up any documents that indicate they have facilities in foreign countries. Well, there are a couple of things to comment in this particular case. Obviously, it's similar in some ways to the dismissal of charges against Oliver North. Beyond that, it's interesting to note, first of all, the endorsement of the situation by G. Robert Blakey, who, of course, was instrumental in helping to cover up the CIA and other national security connections to the assassination of President Kennedy when he was counsel to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the mid and late 1970s. Of course, that particular investigation touches on many of the root events which have led up over the past 20, about the past quarter of a century to the Iran-Contra scandal, going all the way back directly to the JM Wave Station, Theodore Shackley and the boys from the Bay of Pigs operation. It's also interesting to note here, Joseph F. Fernandez's use of words here, reading again, Fernandez said outside the courthouse that the past years have been, quote, extremely difficult for me, unquote. The prosecution of working intelligence agents, quote, sent a chilling message to the men and women of the CIA's clandestine services. Well, one of the major points in my December surprise hypothesis was that a number of different things in December, a number of the different elements in that, served to freeze the linebackers, as I said. In particular, the Pizza Connection 4 case, which could have gone up to many different levels of the Reagan White House, and as it turns out, would have intersected directly with the Iran-Contra scandal, as well as the shooting of the Pope. When Pizza Connection 4 was disclosed on December 2nd of 1988, that undoubtedly has to have had a chilling effect, unquote, on a lot of the people that might have been indicted but so far have not been mentioned in connection with the Pizza Connection cases, and there are four to date. So again, freezing the linebackers, linebackers here being a metaphor for key players, appears to have been what's going on. That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast. Yes, indeed it does. It concludes the prepared portion of that broadcast, which was the Drug Tug case, Part 4. It does not conclude the prepared portion of this broadcast, which we're going to continue with right now. Now, again, bear in mind the intersection between Charles Duck, the fellow who is disposing, or the trustee for the bankrupt LendVest situation, his connections with Peter Robinson. That's as opposed to Calvin Robinson, the Drug Tug skipper, who we're going to touch on again in a second. And Peter Robinson's connection also, in addition to Joseph Russaniello, to Alvaro Berchera of the Medellin cartel. Bear in mind also the illegality of Peter Robinson's representing David Pitner and Charles Duck, when in fact he had not been retired from the U.S. Attorney's Office for a long enough period to do that. And again, LendVest, obviously one of the businesses connected with the Drug Tug case. And of course, Joseph Russaniello's connections to Contra, the insulation, shall we say, of Contra-related drug smuggling activities we took a look at there just a second ago. Again, we haven't got hard connections past a point between these various elements, but it is fascinating the way so many of these same names crop up in the same kinds of operations, and the suspicion is that a lot of these are eventually going to hook up, that if they're not the exact same operation, they certainly are very closely connected. Now, reading from the Napa Sentinel of Friday, March 16th, of 1990, again in the up-the-wall section that Harry has on page 2. He has sort of little quick news blurbs, and this again by Harry Martin, and research credit on this again goes to Dave, our Napa Sentinel with a small s, our listener who's been recruiting this for us. Interesting little article here, interesting little blurb called Look for Campaign Revelations, and it reads as follows. Voters in Congressional District 1 will be hearing about Congressman Doug Bosco's role in being one of the first congressmen on Capitol Hill who tried to block or delay any investigations into the savings and loan industry. As you are aware, this is a hot subject throughout the country. Bosco's CIA connections will also come under scrutiny. One more time. Look for Campaign Revelations is the headline of this little blurb, or the caption. Voters in Congressional District 1 will be hearing about Congressman Doug Bosco's role in being one of the first congressmen on Capitol Hill who tried to block or delay any investigations into the savings and loan industry. As you are aware, this is a hot subject throughout the country. Bosco's CIA connections will also come under scrutiny. Well, at this point, you know as much about this particular blurb as I do. It's interesting that Congressman Bosco was one of the first congressmen to help attempt to block investigations into the SNL scandal, which, as we now know, goes back to a certain extent to CIA and related elements, quite possibly to the Iran-Contra scandal and drug smuggling activities, as we have been looking at. Now, in the first installment of the Drug Tug case, we took a look at a Napa Sentinel article from Friday, September 1st of 1989, that I'm going to repeat in part as follows. Again, Napa Sentinel, 9-1-89, the headline, Bosco intervenes on Hull's behalf. Subheaded, local congressman writes letter to Latin president, accused CIA Contra arms and drug smuggler flees Costa Rica for U.S. safe haven. This is by Harry Martin again. It reads in part, former Arizona rancher John Hull, a reported CIA operative who was also paid by the National Security Council, has fled Costa Rica. Hull is still wanted in that Central American Republic for violating the country's Neutrality Act. Hull is still wanted in that Central American Republic for violating the country's Neutrality Act. Hull is now believed to be in either Indiana or Florida. After Hull was arrested by the Costa Rica Judicial Police on January 12, 1989, on charges of hostile acts against Costa Rica and international drug trafficking, 17 U.S. congressmen wrote a letter to Oscar Arias Sanchez, president of Costa Rica. One of the signatories of the letter was Congressman Doug Bosco, who represents Napa County. The letter's overtones are subject to interpretation depending on whether you are on the receiving end or the sending end of the letter. Bosco is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee. The interference of Bosco and his colleagues irritated not only the Costa Rican president, but also a special drug commission investigating international drug trafficking in that country in association with arms shipments to insurgent Contras in Nicaragua. Though Bosco's office terms the letter diplomatic, the Costa Rican government considered it as interference in the independent affairs of that country. Quote, we urge you to investigate Mr. Hull's case to ensure that the charges against him have been brought with just cause and to ensure that his rights under Costa Rican law and under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights are protected, unquote, the letter bearing Bosco's signature states. Again quoting, it is our hope that Mr. Hull's case can be concluded promptly and that it will be handled in a manner that will not complicate U.S.-Costa Rican relations. The letter further states, and this portion was taken as a threat by the Costa Rican government, quote, as you know, there is much debate in the United States over Central American policy. However, we all seek a fresh start now with a new U.S. president, and we all want to further strengthen the historically close U.S.-Costa Rican relationship. We thus want to avoid situations or incidents that could adversely affect our relations at this time. Well, make of that what you will. It certainly is ambiguous wording, and I personally, and a lot of people obviously, including apparently President Arias, have taken this interpretation. It appears to be the old velvet fist, or iron fist in a velvet glove. I took the letter as one, as an attempt basically to intimidate the Costa Rican government into going lightly on John Hull. But whatever construction one chooses to put on it, it is interesting to see the congressman who represents Napa County and obviously the area in which the whole Drug Tug Lenvest case broke, attempting to, at least that's my interpretation, and others have interpreted it that way, to frustrate or tone down the investigation by the Costa Rican authorities into John Hull's activities, the way in which that intersects, obviously, with the Drug Tug case, as well as so many of the other things that we've been looking at tonight, on the periphery of, or perhaps centrally involved, in the CIA-SNL connection. It's interesting to see that Congressman Bosco is also one of the first people to help try to frustrate the investigation into the savings and loan scandal, which, as we now know, comes back at least in part to the CIA and quite possibly to the very, very same elements who are cropping up in connection with the Drug Tug Lenvest case. Now, apparently, Harry Martin got the information about Doug Bosco from a book, which I'm going to try and get a hold of soon. It's called Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loans. It's by Steve Pizzo, P-I-Z-Z-O, Mary Fricker, and Paul Muolo, M-U-O-L-O. It's interesting, too, to skip down in the Up the Wall column by Harry Martin. Again, same column, same page, Friday, March 16th, 1990. And another little blurb called A New Address, and it reads as follows. What's happened to Calvin Robinson, the skipper of the Drug Tug? He was convicted and sentenced to federal prison last year. So where is he now? In federal prison in Phoenix. What's interesting about his case, after further study, is that he claims he was working with the CIA through a Seattle company. The CIA denied it, but there are records to show that a fake company in Seattle was established through a telephone answering service. Records also show Robinson did call that office and has a business card from that office. Was he right? Question mark? Well, we shall see. Certainly there are abundant indications that that is the case, and as is the case with this very cryptic and, who knows, potentially very weighty comment by Harry Martin. And again, I don't want to accuse Congressman Bosco of anything. I'm waiting to see, as I'm sure our listeners are as well, just what comes of this tantalizing statement. Bosco's CIA connections will also come under scrutiny. But Harry Martin has certainly delivered on this case in the past, and I myself am looking to see whether or not, and obviously this is not a statement I'm making, it's a question I'm asking, whether or not we see some hard link-ups rather than just some apparent circumstantial link-ups between the CIA-SNL case, Iran-Contra scandal, the activities being investigated by the Christic Institute, as well as the, at least to a certain extent, investigated by the Kerry Subcommittee. Are these going to hook up with Drug Tug Lenvest? We shall see. FFT, GFFR, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. Again, the Drug Tug Lenvest case, which appears to hook up in a big way with the Iran-Contra scandal, with the Christic Institute's cast of characters, with the same group that appears to be involved to a certain extent in the Kerry Subcommittee's revelations, such as they are. The same group appears to be involved, and certainly there are indications that they may hook up with the CIA-SNL connection. I've been hitting this particular case so hard because, again, I know, at least up to a point, where the information is coming from, and it's from a very dependable source, and it's basically that the Napa Sentinel is having information leaked to it. There was a very disturbing article which came out in connection with the impending trial of General Noriega, obviously someone who is right in the center of all of these activities, and perhaps all of these activities, as I've said so often during the course of this program, perhaps they're all part of the same operation, different tentacles of the same octopus. But a very, very disturbing article which may have been executed, or the information here may have come to light, at least in part because of the Drug Tug revelations. Well, this appeared in the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, March 14th of 1990. This is an AP story, Dateline Miami headlined, Judge Limits Noriega Evidence. Court Must Approve Classified Material Sought for Defense at Trafficking Trial. And it reads as follows. A federal judge on Tuesday scheduled the drug trafficking trial of ousted Panamanian leader Manuel Antonio Noriega for January of 1991 and issued a sweeping order on how attorneys could handle classified information. U.S. District Judge William Holder's protective order could hinder defense attorneys seeking access to thousands of documents they say will corroborate their assertion that Noriega acted with CIA approval for many years. Holder set the trial of Noriega and four co-defendants for January 28th, 1991. The 12-page protective order sets ground rules defining what may be considered classified national security information in the Noriega case under the Classified Information Procedures Act of 1980. Noriega's attorneys must obtain court approval before seeing any government documents marked confidential, secret, top secret, or sensitive compartmented information, unquote, the judge ruled. Classified information belonging to any federal agency that deals with national security and any documents concerning or relating to national security or intelligence matters are restricted under the order and cannot be made available to the defense without Justice Department approval, Holder said. Information, and here's the really, really staggering part of this article, information in books, newspapers, and other publications is similarly restricted if the published reports include confirmation by someone with access to classified information and if the Justice Department believes it could affect national security, Holder ruled. One more time. Information in books, newspapers, and other publications is similarly restricted if the published reports include confirmation by someone with access to classified information and if the Justice Department believes it could affect national security, Holder ruled. The defense has maintained that information from Noriega's private dealings with foreign intelligence agencies should be allowed as evidence at trial, as well as volumes of information published in newspapers and recent books about Noriega's role in U.S. foreign policy and the war on drugs. Quote, information in the public domain is not ordinarily classified, unquote, Holder acknowledged in his ruling. But that also, I think, has to get something of an award for understatement. No, it generally isn't. One of the things that's very disturbing to me, as someone reads a lot of newspapers in a country where most people really tragically don't read newspapers at all, something like 5% of the American people read newspapers, articles like this are appearing so frequently, articles in which a really staggering restriction of basic constitutional liberties, in this case, basically the right of free speech, the right to conceivably even a fair trial. The public's right to know here is being drastically, drastically limited when information which has already been published can be classified because of national security reasons. This represents a tremendous, tremendous restriction of basically our constitutional liberties. This is a staggering article, and the implications, again, of this could not be exaggerated. I also wonder, too, just how much of this information has to do with the information already on the public record about the CIA, Noriega, the Contra support effort, Messrs. Hull and Company, et cetera, the information we've been dealing with this evening. It's disturbing, too, that there's been so little discussion of the constitutional implications of this particular action. But it's with a solidly reactionary federal judiciary having been seated. We've only had one Democratic president since Lyndon Johnson, and that was a conservative Democrat, Jimmy Carter. He didn't make any Supreme Court appointees. Reagan alone appointed something like two-thirds of all of the seated federal judges, and they serve for a lifetime. This kind of thing is very, very disturbing, and it's even more disturbing that there's so little public discussion of it. The implications of this particular step just couldn't be exaggerated. I wonder to what extent, again, information like the revelations concerning the drug tug case and so forth have influenced this particular judge's decision. And again, by way of encouraging the listeners to this program to do what they can to stimulate discussion about the drug tug case, because its implications really could not be exaggerated. Reviewing again the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle from Christmas Day, that of course December 25th of 1989, our lead story, which we're not going to read, I'm just going to read you the headline. Noriega asks asylum. Subheaded, he surrenders to Vatican envoy, U.S. troops ring papal embassy. Chronicle Wire Services story, Dateline, Panama City. That's the lead story with a banner headline, and that, of course, is at the right-hand side of the page. Then, the second lead story, of course, which is always at the left-hand side of the page, same day, two businessmen in Napa face fraud charges by Tessa DiCarlo, Chronicle correspondent. It reads in part as follows. One Napa businessman is in jail, and another is being sought by police on hundreds of charges of theft and fraud involving companies linked to a record-breaking marijuana and hashish seizure in May of 1988. David Hansen, the former president of LendVest Mortgage Incorporated, was being held yesterday in Napa County Jail on $1 million bail while investigators looked for Robert Pittner, former managing general partner of the Joseph Matthews Winery. According to a report filed with the indictment, LendVest, once Napa County's fastest-growing mortgage firm, supplied millions of dollars to the lavishly restored historic winery in downtown Napa. The mortgage company and the winery went bankrupt after federal investigators linked them to a barge discovered in San Francisco Bay on May 24, 1988, loaded with 57 tons of marijuana and hashish. Skipping down, the Napa indictments, which were filed Friday, are the first attempt to press charges involving the millions of dollars that investors lost after LendVest and Joseph Matthews went bust. Quote, it was a very complex case, and it's going to be very expensive and cost a tremendous amount of local court time, unquote, said Napa District Attorney Jerome Mautner. We didn't really have the ability to do this, but we did it anyway, unquote. Again, I suspect, from what I know about where the information is coming from, that once Noriega escaped, in a sense, once he turned up alive and in the Vatican embassy, these individuals had to be, in a sense, put on ice. They had to be brought under the control of the authorities because they potentially, at least I suspect, David Hansen could release a lot of information. Again, the implications of the drug tug LendVest case couldn't be exaggerated, and it intersects in a very, very big way with, again, Noriega, Medellin cartel, the John Hull operation, and so many of the things which figure around the periphery of, and quite possibly very centrally, in the CIA-SNL link. Very quickly, I'm going to review what we've looked at in tonight's broadcast, and then we're going to take a break, and then it'll be time for the phone-in session of this particular program. We began tonight's broadcast by looking at an L.A. Times article in which Alfredo Sanchez, the upcoming key informant and witness in Noriega's trial, basically his background, his role in some of the key elements involved with the Contra support effort and apparent attendant drug-related drug smuggling activities, the Medellin cartel, Messrs. Escobar and Ochoa, both of them named as defendants in the Christic Institute's lawsuit. This fellow, Alfredo Sanchez, was described in connection with a very big drug smuggling case in Denver. Now, we don't know what that case is, but the question I ask is there any connection between the Denver case that Alfredo Sanchez was involved in and the Sunflow case and or the failure of the Silverado savings and loan that we're going to look at next week? The Alfredo Sanchez in that article was described by one fellow as being the most important witness since Adler Barry Seal. The late Adler Barry Seal himself, a key operator in the Contra-related drug smuggling activities, along with Noriega, along with the Medellin cartel and company. We looked at an article from a Penthouse from July of 89 called Snowbound about Adler Barry Seal, his connections with Casey, Operation Black Eagle, Michael Harari, who miraculously escaped, miraculously here is ironically in quotes, miraculously escaped the U.S. military dragnet down in Panama. He, of course, had helped the Contra support activities and attendant drug-related activities, drug smuggling activities that we have been focusing on this evening. In particular, we took a look at how George Bush's office, and specifically Donald Gregg, was used as a cover for Operation Black Eagle, the Noriega, Medellin, Adler Barry Seal-connected drug smuggling operations that we're looking at. We also took a look in that article at the death of Hugo Spadafora, who denounced Noriega's drug smuggling activities to the very CIA that was cooperating with Noriega. They betrayed that to Noriega, who got rid of Spadafora. We then took a look at how, according to Jack Terrell, a key witness in the Kerry subcommittee's hearings, also a key Christic informant, Jack Terrell testified that none other than three of the employees from Frigoríficos de Puntarenas, which is headed up by Moises Nunez and Frank Chanez, two of the defendants in the Christic Institute suit, who were also very closely associated in the Contra support effort and possibly drug smuggling activities with Frank Castro, one of the people lurking at the periphery of some of the connections pertinent to the People Savings and Loan in Llano and its failure in part as a result of a bad loan to a director of the Sunshine State Bank, Sunshine headed up by Ray and Rafael Corona, founded by money from Tony Fernandez's drug smuggling activities, Frank Castro, one of the unindicted conspirators in the Fernandez operation. After that, of course, we then took a look. We took a jump from that particular article, and we took a look at some of the things that have been breaking concerning the drug tug Landvest case and General Noriega. And again, this obviously figures in a very, very big way. We took a look, first of all, at Joseph Rusiniello's salty comments about Latinos, drug smuggling, and law enforcement. We then took a look at how Joseph Rusiniello, of all people, should know how the Bay Area is an area where Latin drug smugglers can indeed be insulated from law enforcement, though not necessarily from Latinos in this case, at least to a certain extent, apparently, by Joseph Rusiniello himself. We then took a look at how one of Joseph Rusiniello's former assistants, Peter Robinson, is illegally representing Charles Duck, the Landvest bankruptcy trustee. He also apparently is representing David Pittner, a former Landvest officer, as well as Alvaro Becerra of the Medellin cartel. And again, the Peter Robinson, Rusiniello, Charles Duck, John Duff, and the potential connection of all of those people to Hull, etc. Well, again, that's what we've spent our time looking at this evening. After that, too, we took a look at some interesting information coming from the Napa Sentinel, which maintains that Doug Bosco, the congressman who represents Napa County, was one of the very first people to attempt to frustrate the investigation into the savings and loan scandal, which, as we now see, is moving back in the direction of some of these same elements. We then took a look at how Bosco also was one of the 17 congressional signatories to the pressure letter, as I see it, and others have seen it, that was submitted to Oscar Arias, asking him basically to see to it that John Hull received justice, quote-unquote, probably basically serving to reduce the pressure by the Costa Rican authorities on John Hull. We also took a look, too, at some circumstantial evidence indicating that quite possibly Calvin Robinson's claims of CIA protection for his drug tug operation were justified. That, again, from the Napa Sentinel. It'll be interesting to see what the cryptic references to Bosco's CIA connections in the Sentinel eventually come to. We also took a look at a very chilling article which indicates that published information, when it refers to classified information, or when it comes from people with access to classified information, that will not be permitted at Noriega's upcoming trial. A staggering, staggering ruling which, well, again, the constitutional implications couldn't be exaggerated. And then we took a look at a coincidence, which I don't personally think is a coincidence, and which I think indicates or is indicative of just exactly why published information about Noriega will not be permitted at his trial when it's national security related, namely the same day that Noriega turns up alive and well at the Vatican Embassy. Two of the key players in the whole drug tug scenario, the Lenvest case, were pulled in by the Napa district attorney, who said, "We didn't have the resources to do this, but we did it anyway." I suspect that Messrs. Pittner and Hansen are two very frozen linebackers, to use my December surprise metaphor, at this stage of the game.